So are you happy? Not necessarily right at this moment in your life. I'm going to give you a moment to think about that for a second. Now, I don't know what came up for you just in that little bit of time. For some people, the answer to that question is a little slower in coming because there's a lot going on. You know, you can guess. Stuff in the family, work is really hard right now, I got a bill I'm not sure how I'm going to pay, the world is going to hell in a handbasket, then you're asking me if I'm happy? How am I supposed to know? Happiness is mostly subjective, isn't it? What makes one person happy doesn't necessarily bring happiness to a different kind of person, maybe across the street or on the other side of the world. So how do you know? Well, social scientists try to answer that question, and if you're a social scientist type, then I have a report for you. It is the second World Happiness Report, published apparently every 5 years. Maybe you've heard about it, if only on late-night talk shows monologues. It's popped up recently because it was just released. The Happiness Report is issued by the United Nations, and it's based on a World Gallup poll that was first conducted over a couple of years around the world between 2011 and 2013, and it's now been repeated again between 2016 and 18. And I certainly don't have time to tell you all about the metrics and statistics that they used, but I'll tell you the headline that attracted the late-night talk show hosts' comedians' attention, which is, the United States barely stayed in the top 20 of countries for their ranking in happiness. We actually dropped from number 15 to number 19. Guess who's at the top once again? You're close. I'm Icelandic. They were fourth. The Scandinavian countries. Besides Iceland at number four, we have Norway, Denmark, and world number one, Finland. Any Finns here? No Finns. Okay. I don't know. Maybe they just did the polling in the summer up there. And they So despite all of the social factors that were described as sources of happiness or unhappiness in the World Happiness Report, people at all ends of the economic spectrum and all kinds of different cultures who were surveyed for the poll, different kinds of people, were able to answer yes, pretty categorically, that they were happy in their lives. And maybe for some of you here today, that answer came easily. The easy yes, not because you have no difficulties to deal with in your life, but because there is a foundation that you have built, that your life rests upon, that sustains happiness even during times when life is not all that you hoped it might be, or when you are beset by a time of change and crisis. So that's what I want to talk about today, is that foundation and how you build it, and how this congregation is committed to helping create the building blocks of that foundation. And I wanted you to hear that brief reading from the Dalai Lama, because I think that it is a simple, and a famous American has said, self-evident truth about our lives. That the purpose of our lives and the motion of our lives is to seek happiness. Jefferson wrote it in the Declaration of Independence, that this was a right that we have in this country, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So does it sound sort of self-centered, self-absorbed to suggest that one of the purposes of our living and, in fact, our congregational community is to help us realize happiness? Well, maybe it depends on how we understand what happiness involves. And we can understand it objectively as social scientists, but subjectively, there's been a whole recent publishing industry in the last decade or so that's popped up. In fact, the Dalai Lama's book was very a big seller in that happiness publication wave that kind of flowed over us a few years ago. So there's not much I probably will say today that you couldn't read in a book or see in a video or a blog. But I want to talk about things maybe you already know today, because this morning you made a decision not to stay home and watch a video or read stuff on your computer or on a book. You thought that you would come here and spend your Sunday morning in church. For whatever reason, you decided that being here would be something that could contribute to your happiness. Now, for thousands of years, religions of different origins and traditions have been teaching that there's a connection between doing that, coming to a religious service, and happiness. A lot of them frame it, though, in terms of there's a connection between your holiness and your happiness. In other words, that being happy in this life is not necessarily as important as making sure that you're going to be happy in the next life, because that's the one that lasts forever, and you want to make sure you've got that one covered. Your ticket to the happiness that is possible in the next life, according to many different religious traditions, is how you live a holy life now, regardless of how happy that makes you, because some of the things you're asked to do can be not very comfortable. A holy life is also supposed to be involved with submitting to the authority of teachings, some of them described as infallible teachings about the ultimate origins and meaning and authority that guides our understanding of life and what it's all about. Now, some of you may recognize that from experiences in previous other faith traditions, but I'm not talking about any particular religion here. They exist both in the East and the West, but they all share a formula for holiness that has conditioned human beings over the centuries and has, I think, helped to maintain religious organizations as part of unjust and oppressive social systems. Because millions and millions of people have come to believe that the foundations of their lives were either secured or were insecure based on whether they believed they were destined somehow for heaven or hell. And millions of people have been held hostage to those kinds of beliefs by authorities of religion and state who were invested in convincing people that they held the keys to those kingdoms of heaven and hell and had to be obeyed as a result. Despite all of the changes in human consciousness and understanding that have happened, especially in the last couple of centuries, there are plenty of human beings, we know this from reading the newspapers every day, still willing to surrender their own lives or inflict incredible suffering on others because they believe that happiness in this life is inconsequential compared to the reward that they can get in the next one. But I do have to say that I think across most of the world, and certainly in the West, that the overall direction of human experience and thinking and faith has been away from this direction. We're moving in the right direction. And the Universalist Church had a small part in that movement. At the end of the 19th century, it was the fastest growing church in America. 50 years after that, it had plateaued and had actually started to decline. And why did that happen? It was because a cutting-edge teaching that was controversial at the time that they were emerging and growing in America, the teaching that God is love and that there is no literal hell, was slowly becoming not cutting-edge anymore, but mainstream. So if you are, or come from, or have friends who are Methodists or Presbyterians or Congregationalists or Episcopalians today, you know, that belief in hell and judgment is still historically part of those traditions, but they don't proclaim them much or anywhere near as loudly as they used to. And certainly in those congregations, at Aunt Minnie's funeral, you're not going to hear the preacher saying that she's going to be burning in hell because she didn't come to church often enough. It doesn't happen. Well, how about the evangelicals? you might say. Don't they continue to preach a message that includes the old idea that God's plan includes heaven for those who believe correctly and hell for those who don't? And that is true, many do. But I also have to say, and you can check this out yourself, if you look at their websites or their videos, especially the most successful of the non-denominational megachurches, the promotional materials that they put out, where they include interviews with members and information about what they offer, about why their church exists and what it means in their lives, here is what you hear those folks saying. I'm here because it's helped me understand there is a God who loves me and has a purpose for my life. And I am finding that purpose through community and service in this congregation. I think that's much more the key to their growth. And they're not saying much that they're looking for an insurance policy for heaven. They might express compassion for people who haven't found what they've found. And they might, if pushed, say, yeah, I think they're going to hell. But I don't think they're being attracted to those congregations by fear or anxiety. They're being drawn by their own need to find meaning and purpose in life. And that's the same message that we've been preaching through Universalism and Unitarianism in this church for the last 200 years. That the best way we can understand God is through our experiences of love. That if God is anything, it is the love that you experience and a sense that this world is based in love and that you can lead a happy life of meaning and purpose, and this place is here to help. So churches of all kinds, I think, are finding instead of a sanctimonious holiness being the key to happiness, they are instead trying to preach a message of wholeness, 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 which is actually our worship theme for this month. Wholeness is a good word to describe the foundation of happiness in life. And in the second part of the sermon today, we're going to talk a little bit about the building blocks that can create a foundation of wholeness and a probability of happiness. But let me first invite another short reading, this also from the same Islamic tradition that our story for all ages today was from.
"Oh, great sage Nasruddin," said the eager student, "I must ask you a very important question, the answer to which we all seek. What is the secret to attaining happiness?" Nasruddin thought for a time and then responded, "The secret of happiness is good judgment." "Ah," said the student, "but how do we attain good judgment?" "From experience," answered Nasruddin. "Yes," said the student, "but how do we attain experience?" "Bad judgment."
It would be really easy for me today to preach a sermon about how not to be happy. And you might have an easier time appreciating it too, because we have probably all racked up a pretty good list of life experiences and attitudes that we have found made us miserable. So let's see, where should I begin? I have made myself unhappy in my life because I wanted to be in a different body, you know, bigger, not such a little guy. More handsome. I've made myself unhappy because I long to have a partner, and then because I long to have a different partner. I've been unhappy because there was something I wanted to buy and I couldn't, and then I was unhappy because I bought it and I didn't feel good about it after I bought it. I've been miserable feeling imprisoned by being a parent and miserable when my kids left home. I felt bad about how stingy I am with my time and my money, and I felt bad about how much of both I give away. So I'm really good at that kind of thing. Bad judgment certainly can lead us down a path that makes us unhappy, and we may learn about something not to do, but we don't necessarily have to expect that doing the opposite is what's going to make us happy. And that's because happiness, I think, is not the result of just one life circumstance being exactly the way you want it. It's the result of something that's underneath all of the circumstances, and I've called it a foundation of wholeness that our lives can rest on and are not shaken, even in the most difficult losses or challenges. So I believe that we feel whole and we feel stable on that foundation when we've got four things going on that are part of our foundation of wholeness. The first is when we feel confident in our own worth and dignity as a human being. The second is when we feel that we are enough and we have enough, and that can help us be generous with who and we are and what we have. The third is that when we feel loved, and that can be in our primary relationships or in the larger community in which we participate. And the fourth thing is that we feel needed, that our life is making a difference. So I want to say a word about each of these four building blocks that are so, you know, intuitive once you hear them. Building blocks for wholeness. Confidence in your own worth and dignity as a human being. That's our lead teaching, you know, the key phrase in the first principle of Unitarian Universalism, that every individual has that worth and dignity. And we start with that. That's our number one thing, because no human being can feel whole if their worth and dignity is being ignored or dismissed or denied. And we see this understanding in modern educational theory that not only emphasizes rote knowledge and that kind of intellectual growth, but also a feeling of self-esteem and worth being developed in the social context of a classroom. And there are some of us in this room, I know, who have spent a lifetime coming to terms with a personal identity or status that the majority culture that surrounds us has denied or disrespected. To feel like a whole person and to find personal happiness, I think you have to have a sense of your own worth and dignity, no matter what the society or your family or anyone else says that you are. And our church is committed to that. We teach here as well that everyone who comes here enough. You have enough. You are enough to be generous with what you have and who you are and what you have to offer. And, you know, we often think about something like this as having to do with money, and it does in part. In the World Happiness Report, they made the obvious observation, sort of proven by their study, that wealthier people are likely to be happier than poorer people. Duh. You know, no big revelation there. But recognizing people need a basic income that can sustain a safe home, suitable nourishment, a safe and healthy body, and that people plagued with poor health and with tension about where their livelihood is going to come from are definitely going to be more unhappy. We also have to recognize that everyone is connected, and that unhappiness affects everybody. That's why peace, freedom, and justice are critical in our understanding of what being a religious person means and how we strive for that. I can't argue with one aspect of this economic dimension of being and having enough, which is that feeling that you are enough should not depend on whether or whatever you think it would mean to have enough money. A lot of our economic well-being is more about anxiety about money than about how much you really have or how much you really want. So we find, as the World Happiness Report said, happy people in every social class in every country. The picture we have in our heads of how much we need financially makes a big difference in how happy we feel about where we are and who we are. And unlike prosperity gospel churches or self-help books, we aren't going to tell you that your social or economic status is something that you are responsible for creating by your positive thinking or self-defeating thinking. Because we look critically at our place as individuals and as a church community in structures within our society that help determine that. Our society's class structure and our participation in the dynamics of power and privilege that create racism and oppression. So we know and we recognize and we talk about in this church not just the aspects of happiness that are involved with the attitude you bring, but also about oppressive structures and policies that keep people in their places. If we truly believe in the individual worth and dignity of every human person, we must use what privilege and power we have to connect our self-interest and happiness to the happiness of others. Because when we feel like we are enough, we find happiness in being generous with who we are and what we have. In this church, a third thing that we teach is that you are lovable and loving, and that your relationships with others in partnerships and friendships and in community is critical to your happiness. You know, some studies about happiness have painted a dim picture about single people and their potential for being happy people when compared to people who have partners. But at the same time, we know that partnership is no automatic ticket to happiness. If we are talking about wholeness in our living, we have to recognize that even those who have long-standing partnerships can't base our happiness on one single magic relationship. All loving relationships end in loss. But such losses do not end love in our lives. And wholeness in living means that we are staying connected to friendships and communities that draw upon those same loving feelings that we commit to a life partner, but that we can experience in a broader way in community. And I think both single people and people in partnerships face the same challenge in seeking relationships and community. And maybe people in strong partnerships even have a bigger challenge of reaching out beyond their marriages or their partnerships. The disease that is running rampant in our Western culture as we grow in wealth but decline in community is loneliness. In a world where we hear the word community used early and often, it is so valuable to have some place like this where there is an honest week-to-week effort to build face-to-face community, where friendship is nurtured, where people are included no matter what their partnership status may be, and where all loving relationships are honored and recognized. And the last building block in a life of wholeness that can sustain happiness is knowing that you make a difference and that you are needed. And in this church, we try to make that obvious. You know, some of us feel that through the jobs that we do and through volunteer roles that we have outside this congregation. And many of us who have become parents feel that in the way that we are loved and needed by our children. But we're not all parents, and we're not all active in life outside this room. Some of us are retired. So there are changes that we go through in our lives when commitment is less intense. And meaningful work is needed all the time through the lifespan, no matter where we are, that can involve your commitment to some kind of service in a regular form, daily, weekly, monthly, something that you do to connect, to give, and to feel like you make a difference. In this interdependent world, as I've said, our self-interest and our happiness is inextricably tied to everybody else's. And so the service that we can perform can even be something that's as simple as changing habits that we have, that we live in our daily lives, that may actually make a small difference in the world. And so in this church, we teach that commitment as well as part of wholeness, a commitment to service, knowing that every small way that we act in service of others makes a difference, not only to those immediately around us, but we believe to the whole interdependent web of life. Being a happy person is never the result of making no mistakes. Rather, it is a result of learning from all your mistakes, that you are a whole person nevertheless, a person whose life is important and needed because of the ways that you can give and serve, because of the ways that you are a person who loves and takes care of others, because of your gratitude for the way that you receive that love from others, because you are a person of infinite worth and dignity who knows that your life does not belong just to you, but to everybody else who has gone before you, and everybody that lives today, and everybody that is going to follow us tomorrow. All of us connected is one part of this amazing life that we all share. May it be so.